Good morning. I'd like to thank everybody again for last Sunday's gathering. The welcome home. That was last Sunday, wasn't it? We do appreciate it very much. Just you being there was that was special. The gifts, appreciate those certainly, but just the support that you've given us ever since Letta's ordeal began. Notice it's her ordeal, it's not necessarily mine. But do appreciate it. I can't shake this sinus or this cold or whatever, but I protest to taking any sort of decongestant today because I think that makes me feel worse. So not complaining, just explaining. Sorry about the size of the font. I've already heard a little rumbling through the crowd or about the size of the font in the worksheet. I just try to keep it on one page, and lesson learned. So when you see the word history, I know that makes you say, "Ugh," probably. I've always been a fan of history, American history, and more importantly, Bible history. I realize that it can be very dry and boring, and we don't want that to happen. But as far as my assignments at the School of Preaching, for years I've taught church history. And I enjoy that to a point. An opportunity arose to sacrifice that class for a textual class. I already had the history of Israel 1, which encompasses 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles. And so I sacrificed church history so I could go ahead and teach the whole thing all the way through Kings and Chronicles. And so you're doing me a favor. It's been a while since I've taught the Kings and 2 Chronicles, and so I thought I might kill two birds with one stone. I've got a notebook full of notes that I typed up probably 10 years ago on the Kings, but anytime I do something after a long period of time, I generally just start all over from scratch pretty much. So that's what I've done. Now this morning is kind of the nuts and bolts of a situation. And what we need to remember is when we talk about Bible history, some people like to talk about or use the word history in this way. It's his story. Whose story? History is his story. It's God's story. If we believe that God intervenes in the affairs of men, that he's sovereign, that he had a plan from the foundation of the world, then everything that's gone on in some sense is his story. From the beginning to the coming of Christ, and now from the coming of Christ the first time to his second appearance, the culmination of all things, it's all God's story, unfolding. Have you ever found that when you read the Old Testament, after you get through maybe, Exodus, and only then up until about the first 20 chapters, do you find that suddenly it just doesn't seem to make as much sense anymore? At least for a time, as you read through the first five books, Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy, although there are narratives in Numbers, there's a lot of laws that don't seem to make any sense to us. They seem strange. They seem foreign. And then finally, people get into the land. The Old Testament, if you just pick it up and open it and start reading, oftentimes it can lead to great confusion. What's going on here? But here's what I want us to remember. First 11 chapters of Genesis, remember we discussed, have four great events. The creation, the fall, the flood, the Tower of Babel. Those first 11 chapters explain why we're in the mess we are. Because sin has entered the world. Once sin entered the world in Genesis 3, the first thing we read about in Genesis 4 is murder. Then we read Genesis 6 through 9, the world becoming increasingly wicked to the point that God has to destroy it. He's forced, because of his justice, to destroy the world, to cleanse it, and to start all over with one family. What family was that? Noah's family. And then once things start over again, this cleansing by water, it's not too long before we see the nations around the world on the face of the earth becoming prideful, desiring to build a tower into heaven, some think, perhaps to escape another flood, if they could possibly do that, if God's the one bringing it. And so God scatters the people, scatters the nations, and confuses their languages. And then from Genesis 12 through Genesis 50, we have Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. And with the call of Abraham, God promises to fashion a nation. What happens in chapter 11 of Genesis, the Tower of Babel, the nations are scattered, their languages are confused, they're in sin, they're in rebellion. And so God says, through one man, Abraham, I will bring about a great nation, a great host of people. And through that nation, I will bring one into the world who will have a physical connection to Abraham, who will bless all peoples, all nations, all families. So here's what you need to remember when you read the Old Testament. It's all looking forward to the coming of that one. That one who would bless all the families of the earth. That one who would destroy, who would crush the head of the serpent, Genesis 3 and verse 15. Every chapter of every book, every verse in some way is pointing toward whom? Toward Christ. Every single one. So, when you're reading through the Old Testament, it's the history of Israel. The history of Israel. Remember, Jacob's name was changed to Israel. And Israel then had 12 sons. And from those sons came a host of peoples who now make up the nation of Jacob, the nation of Israel. So the entirety of the Old Testament, practically, except for just a few pieces here and there where Gentile nations are discussed, it's all about God's dealing with Jacob's posterity, Abraham's descendants, the nation of Israel. Why? What's he going to use that nation for? To bring Jesus into the world. And so the Old Testament says Jesus is coming. Jesus is coming. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John say Jesus has come. Acts through Revelation says Jesus is coming again. His story is all about the salvation of man to the glory of God by Jesus Christ our Lord. Okay? So what do we find by the time we come to 1 Kings? What's happened? God's people are now a great host. They're in the land of Canaan, the land that God promised. Initially, God was their king, but they demanded one like the nations round about them. That's recorded in 1 Samuel. Their first king was Saul, but remember, because of his pride and his disobedience, the kingdom was stripped from him, was torn from him, and given to another. Saul was of the tribe of Benjamin. But God had plans for a king to come from Judah. So he chose a young man by the name of David. So you have the rule of Saul, the rule of David. And the rule of Saul marks what in Bible history is referred to as the United Kingdom. You have Saul, you have David. David's life runs up until the beginning of 1 Kings. David dies. What king takes his place? Solomon. The United Kingdom consists of Saul, David, and Solomon. 120 years of unity. But with the rise of Rehoboam, Solomon's son, as king, 1 Kings 12, the kingdom divides. It splits. So you have now northern Israel, 10 tribes, and Judah, primarily the tribe of Judah, but Benjamin as well. You have a divided kingdom, north, south. And so after 1 Kings 12, you start to read about Judah and northern Israel. Who's northern Israel? Those 10 tribes who didn't want to listen to Rehoboam, who was of the tribe of Judah, king. And so they split. And you read of Judah, those two tribes to the south. And so once we get to 1 Kings, for a short period of time, we're looking at Solomon's reign, where the kingdom is still united. But then from that point forward, there's a divided kingdom. You say, all of those kings and all of those names and all of those events, what's it all about? Why do we even need to know? Here's what you need to remember. God is working in and among those people. Why? Why bring Jesus into the world? He's honing them. He's sharpening them. He's fashioning them into what he wants. And we'll say more about that as we go along. But here's just some basic background information. I know this is just nuts and bolts. You don't have to write it down. If it just causes your eyes to roll in the back of your heads, then just think happy thoughts for a moment. Okay? Some basic background. You know, who wrote the book of Matthew? Matthew. Who wrote the book of Luke? Who wrote the book of Acts? Luke. But it doesn't, we have to kind of, that's implied, right? Some books tell us exactly who wrote them and some don't. Book of Hebrews, who wrote Hebrew? Some might say Paul, but we don't know for sure. Who wrote 1 and 2 Kings? Well, if you read from 1 Kings 1 to the end of 2 Kings, there's no author mentioned. So who wrote it? Now, the Jews believe that Jeremiah wrote it. Jeremiah was a prophet who lived before and then afterward what we refer to as the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians. Now, your eyes are already rolling in the back of your head, but just understand that was a very important period in Israelite history when that temple that Solomon would build was destroyed. Jeremiah was there. Jeremiah warned them about it, but they didn't listen. And so some think that these books were written by Jeremiah. Nobody knows for sure. Some are inclined to believe that whoever this author was, he may have written 1 and 2 Kings, but also Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel. But we don't know for certain. But those are just some ideas. Now, what's interesting about the Kings is, and this in no way speaks in a disparaging way about inspiration, and it's true, the author of Kings used sources to write his book. What do you mean by that? In other words, there were historical documents available for him to peruse through and then write down what he did. Okay? Now, he very well may be, particularly if it's Jeremiah, would have some firsthand information about all this. But notice this. Talking about some of the sources that were perhaps used. They're actually mentioned in the Kings. They're mentioned in the Kings. For instance, 1 Kings 11 and verse 41. I'll just turn over there and read it for you. After Solomon dies, it says, "Now the rest of the acts of Solomon, all that he did, and his wisdom, are they not written in the book of the Acts of Solomon?" So what does that seem to imply? The writer of 1 and 2 Kings had read those that book. He'd gone through those documents. He was familiar with it, and in some sense probably helped him in putting together this inspired account of God's people. So we have the Acts of Solomon reference. Then chapter 14 and verse 19. Very similar language. Says, after the death of Jeroboam, king of Israel, it says, "Now the rest of the acts of Jeroboam, how he made war and how he reigned, indeed, they are written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel." That very well, that's probably not the Chronicles that we have. It's probably another historical set of documents that the writer had at his disposal. And then 1 Kings 14:29, again similar language. "Now the rest of the acts of Rehoboam and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah?" So he probably used these sources, but what we want to note is inspiration works this way. I think some people think that inspiration works something like this. A writer is kind of overcome and possessed by the Spirit of God. He sits down with wide open eyes, takes a pen, and just starts going like this. You know, kind of like automatic writing of occultism. But that's not inspiration. Inspiration worked in this way. A man of God, he has his own personality, his own characteristics, his own sphere of understanding and knowledge, his own way of putting things. He would then, by God's Spirit, pen the works of God, using his own or being filtered through his own personality, his own language, his own idiosyncrasies, and when the final product was set forth, although certainly you can see the man in the work, who's behind the man? God. That's inspiration. That's why when you read Paul's letters, they differ from Peter's, right? Oftentimes they'd use a lot of different words. Words that were very familiar to Paul, Peter might not use them because they just weren't words he used. So this in no way takes away from inspiration. We have an inspired compiling, if you will, and telling of the story. For all scriptures given by what? Inspiration of God. That's talking about the Old Testament specifically, although it certainly applies to the New Testament as well. So, whoever this author was, he had a number of historical records at his disposal. When was this book written, or these books? Some believe somewhere around 550. And the reason being is, when you look at the events, the final events of 2 Kings, there should be a parenthesis right here, but there's not. My secretary is falling down on the job. That's me, by the way. They took place about 560, which was the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiakim, which is recorded in 2 Kings 25. When you read the closing verses of the book of 2 Kings, it seems to be during the time of Babylonian exile, which lasted until about 537 B.C. And here's what's really important, I suppose. When we talk about when this book was written, I thought I had it on this particular screen, but this kind of brings it home a little bit. Who's the audience? Since it's sometime regarding Jehoiakim's exile, and exile still seems to be going on when the books were written, it was when the people were in Babylon that this book was written. You're thinking, my head, my head, my head, oh my head. Let me explain what that means so that maybe it'll be helpful. What do we say these books deal with? Beginning with a united kingdom, then a divided kingdom, right? Okay, what ends, what causes these kingdoms to collapse and finally be completely destroyed? Captivity. Northern Israel were taken by the Assyrians about 721 B.C. They were taken away. These armies invaded the lands of the north. They conquered, and they took back the best and the brightest to Assyria. And they left the poor, they left the uneducated, and then they even had their own people come in and live, and they intermarried, and that's where we get the Samaritans, by the way, of John chapter 4. So the Assyrians overthrew northern Israel. 150, 60 years later or so, Judah, the only kingdom left, remember David's tribe and the Benjamites, they make the same mistakes. And so then God uses the Babylonians to come in. And they destroy Jerusalem and they destroy the temple and they carry away the best and the brightest like Daniel and like Ezekiel and many others. Okay. And they were in Babylonian exile for 70 years. Okay. 70 years, 7 decades. It's believed that the kings were written to them while they were still there. Why? They're going to be there 70 years, but prophecy said after 70 years, what would happen? They go back to that land. Now, if they're going to go back to that land and be successful in it, what did they need to do? They needed to be faithful. What caused them to go into captivity, to lose everything? Unfaithfulness. When they go back, they're going to need to be faithful. And so it's believed that the kings was a reminder of why they'd gone into exile. Why did they go? Why did God punish them? Did he not love them anymore? No, they were guilty of heinous infidelity. They were guilty of sin. Here's what's interesting. As we might see this morning, I have to look at my watch a lot this morning, since you can't see the clock. Both Israel and Judah became gross idolaters, worshiping the gods of the heathen that they didn't run out of the land. Once they come back from captivity, those in Judah, there's no more idolatry. When you read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, do you ever even smell a hint of any service or devotion to some other god than Jehovah? No. Absolutely not. Why? Because captivity kicked idolatry out of the Israelites. And that's what its purpose was for, to discipline them. Why is it necessary for idolatry to be kicked out of the Israelites? So that they can serve as God's people. And why do they need to serve as God's people? So they can be the catalyst through and by which God brings Jesus into the world. Were they perfect when Jesus arrived? No. But there was no idolatry. So, that's a little bit about the audience. We'll pick it up just a little bit here in just a second. How can we summarize these books? All right, and this is what I want us to know. First of all, when you read 1 Kings through 2 Kings, you need to see the king among all the others. Notice, when you talk about northern Israel and Judah, their kings, there were some good ones in Judah. How many good kings were there in northern Israel? Does anybody remember? Not a single one. What about the best kings of Judah? Were they perfect, sinless, flawless? No. People said, we want a king. God said, I'll give you one, but I've got another one in mind. The one I have in mind is flawless and sinless and perfect. The one I have in mind will sit on a throne that is eternal. The one that I have in mind will establish a kingdom that shall never be shaken. When you read about all these kings, remember there's one coming. He's not going to make the mistakes that these make. He's not going to have the weaknesses that these have. He's going to be better than the best of those that shine at least temporarily. Sing the king. 2 Kings chapter 1, or 1 Kings chapter 1, Solomon is on the throne. Israel is united. Solomon's reign, oftentimes along with David's, but particularly Solomon's, is referred to as the golden era of Israel. It's when nationally they were as prosperous as they ever were. When they were at their height economically. When people from all over came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. We'll say more about that in a moment. But by the time we get to 2 Kings, it goes from glory, a golden age, to what? Captivity. So to sum up both books, from glory, Solomon's reign, to captivity, the last chapter, both in 2 Kings and in Chronicles, describes the carrying away of Judah. Northern Israel is described sooner, but from glory to captivity. And then I like this one. The beginning chapters of 1 Kings, Solomon builds the temple. Remember that story about his great prayer and the dedication and God's presence being so strong, the priests couldn't remain therein. So we have 2 Kings chapter 1, the early chapters, through chapter 9 or so, the temple's built. But by the time we come to the end of the book, what happens? The temple is burned. I find that really interesting. From the temple being built to the temple being burned, that encapsulates 1 and 2 Kings. Here's your little outline of 1 Kings. Very simple. First 11 chapters. United Kingdom. 12 through 22, divided kingdom. United and divided. United and divided. That's what it's all about when you read these books. Glory to decay. Glory to captivity. God's people in riches, it ends in rags. Usually it's the opposite, that story, right? From rags to riches. God's story for His people, from riches to rags. 2 Kings outline. Very similar. The divided kingdom, it's still continuing through chapter 17. Chapter 17, Israel falls. Then 18 through 25, the surviving kingdom. After Israel goes, the only kingdom left is Judah. Remember, God is preserving Judah because it's through that line in that house and those kings, Jesus comes into the world. He will be the lamb of the tribe, or the lion of the tribe of Judah. He is a lamb and a lion. Thank you, Tom Moore. The lion of the tribe of Judah. First and Second Kings outline. We outline them together. We might do it like this. 1 through 11, the golden age. Solomon's on the throne. Chapter 12 of 1 Kings through 2 Kings 17, the kingdom is torn. It's divided again. And then 18 through 25, the last days. the last thing. I want to get through this real quick. Yeah, this is nuts and bolts. Eventually, we'll get into political intrigue and hostility and miraculous power and interesting personalities, all strewn throughout. But right now, we've got to kind of set the stage just a tad. Let's think about how 2 Chronicles fits into this. 2 Chronicles is basically the same material that you find in 1 and 2 Kings much of the time, but there's a different emphasis and a different stress. When you study 1 and 2 Kings, it's about the kings of Israel and Judah. Both of them are documented and described. But when you study 1 and 2 Chronicles, the kings that are spotlighted, not Israel, although they'll be mentioned briefly, the kings that are spotlighted in the Chronicles are the kings of Judah. Why Judah? The lion of the tribe of Judah. It's through David's line, his descendants that Jesus would bring, not the Israelite kings. And the Israelite kings were basically just a series of dynasties. One guy would come to power, he'd have a son, he'd rule after him, and somebody would kill that son, and he'd go to power, he'd have a couple sons, they'd rule, and somebody would kill that son. I mean, that's just one after the other. A lot of blood and guts and gore in a lot of the political maneuverings when you read these books. The Bible doesn't hold back to describe what goes on. But let's talk a little bit about 2 Chronicles real quick. It's believed that the author of 2 Chronicles was Ezra, written after exile. Probably about 450, 430 B.C. The people are already back in the land after being in captivity for 7 years. Chronicles was written to provide a spiritual perspective on the historical events from the time of David to Cyrus's decree. Cyrus is the one who signed the decree that allowed the people to return after captivity. It traces Israel's lineage back to the dawn of human race. And forward to the end of the Babylonian captivity. Why? To reveal God's faithfulness and continued purpose for His people. That's important. We believe 1 and 2 Kings was written while they were in exile to explain why they went. The Chronicles, perhaps, was written with the idea in mind to show that even though they went into exile, now they were back, and God still had plans for them. He had not given up on His people. Two books, much of which deal with the same material, but a different emphasis, different stress. And again, as we said, the Chronicles spotlights the kings of Judah. All right, so here's your outline of 2 Chronicles. 1-9, Solomon's glory. 10-36, Judah's decline and exile. United kingdom, divided kingdom. Glory, captivity. Solomon's glory, Judah's decay. Same thing. Got just a few seconds to look at a few things. Anybody have any questions? I told you, this is nuts and bolts. We'll start the text, Lord willing, next time. You're saying, I'm not coming to Sunday morning Bible class anymore. Well, here's something interesting. We get to chapter 1. David's sick and can't get warm, and they hire a woman to sleep with him to keep him warm. That's weird, isn't it? Read 2 Kings chapter, 1 Kings chapter 1 through chapter 11 before next week. There's a lot of stuff in there that'll make you go, huh? That's a strange medicinal remedy for the numbness and cold of old age for poor circulation of the blood, isn't it? I just brought that up so you'll think, man, maybe I do need to come. What's that all about? Who is that? Have you ever wondered why God allows peoples and nations to struggle, to face all kinds of difficulty? He's pressing them to repent. Why? Because generally when we go through difficult times, hard times, stressful times, what do? That's when we're most prone to turn back to God. What happened after 9/11 for just a brief span? Suddenly everybody wanted to go to church. God was pressing. Or at least he could have been. I don't like to speak on behalf of God when he hasn't told me personally about what was going on. But it's not beyond the realm of possibility. Let's notice the key chapters here. Chapter 4, 1 Kings. We just got just a few minutes. The Golden Age. This one chapter kind of, again, summarizes everything we're going to see. In 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 1, it says, "So King Solomon was king over all Israel." There's your United Kingdom. You drop down to verse 20, 1 Kings chapter 4. "Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand by the sea in multitude, eating and drinking and rejoicing. So Solomon reigned over all kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines as far as the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life." And then beginning there in verse 22, there's a very interesting description of all of Solomon's accumulation and wealth and prestige and prosperity. This is Israel's golden age. Look at chapter 12, second key chapter. Remember, Rehoboam comes to the throne, and the people say, "If you'll lighten our load, we'll serve you faithfully." Who did Rehoboam listen to? Anybody remember? He didn't listen to the aged counselors. Who did he listen to? He listened to his friends, and they said, "You need to be stronger and harsher than your father was." So he comes back, and he basically says, "I'm going to put it on you, people." And if you'll drop down to verse 16, it says, "Now when all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, the people answered the king, saying, 'What share have we in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To our tents, O Israel. Now see to your own house, O David.'" So Israel departed to their tents. What does that mean? The kingdom was divided. Because Rehoboam was a fool, the kingdom was split. So now we got two peoples. United Kingdom, Solomon. Then with Rehoboam, divided kingdom. Northern Israel, Judah. Turn to the end of the book. Acts, turn to 1 Kings, or 2 Kings 17. The golden age, the divided kingdom. 2 Kings 17, verse 5. What happens to northern Israel? We won't read all of it, but it says, "Now the king of Assyria," 2 Kings 17, 5, "went throughout all the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it for 3 days. In the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Israel away to Assyria," or took Samaria and carried Israel away to Assyria, "and placed them in Hala and by Habor, the river of Gozan, in the cities of the Medes." And then it's described why that happened, because of their idolatry. So in 2 Kings 17, Israel falls. So from about chapter 13 or so of 1 Kings through 2 Kings 17, we have Israel's last days. Then what about the last chapter of 2 Kings, also recorded in chapter 25, also recorded in 2 Chronicles 36. Verse 1, 2 Kings 25, "It came to pass in the ninth year of his reign, in the tenth month, on the tenth day of the month, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all his army came against Jerusalem and encamped against it, and they built the siege wall against it all around. So the city was besieged until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. By the ninth day of the fourth month, the famine had become so severe that the city, in the city, that there was no food for the people of the land. Then the city wall was broken through, and all the men of war fled at night by way of the gate between two walls, which was by the king's gate, even though the Chaldeans were still encamped all around against the city. And the king went by the plain. But the army of the Chaldeans pursued the king, and they overtook him in the plains of Jericho. All his army was scattered." And so what we have, as we look down through here without reading all of it, Jerusalem falls. Zedekiah the king tries to escape, but he's captured, and his sons are killed before him, and his eyes are put out. The last thing he ever saw was his sons being executed. And he was taken off to Babylon, and Judah fell. So now what do we have? We have God's people dispersed and scattered, just as God said would happen if they disobeyed Him. But 70 years of captivity, they'll come back. And things will be different to some degree. And then Jesus will come. Any questions? What I say? I don't know. Next week we'll get to that, to David's lack of warmth and his gal pal to keep him warm.